Welcome to Universal Tenders, your one-stop tender service provider for all tender needs. We haul out tenders up to 47 feet and 25,000 pounds, ensuring safe and efficient handling. Our paint and fiberglass expert team offers comprehensive repair services, from basic touch-ups to full restorations. We provide certified engine services, offering maintenance, rebuilds, and repowering solutions. Additionally, we are proud to be a trusted Suzuki Marine dealership. Our facility also features a fully stocked marine supply store, offering a wide range of accessories and parts for your vessel. At Universal Tenders, we pride ourselves on precision tender services, ensuring your vessel receives the highest quality care. Contact us today to schedule your next service or repair.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Rich as Fuck podcast, the show where we talk about money, investing, and getting rich whilst living that yachty life. Today, I have a very special guest with me, Carla Venter, aka Money with Carla. Very honored to have you here. Everyone listening, I'm Charles, aka the Yachting Investor. We look forward to chatting today. And just before we get stuck into it, please remember to read the disclaimer. This should not be misconstrued as financial advice. This is purely informative and educational. Yada, yada, yada. Okay. Hello, Carla. Welcome. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks, Shaul. Thanks for having me. And really excited to be here. I just, random thoughts. How is your audience split between South Africans versus non-South African?
So I often look at our stats from where the views come from. So yachting is predominantly South Africans at the moment. So about 60-70% of the audience is South African, which is funny because I think they'll all quickly realize that both of us are pretty Afrikaans, and ideally we would have spoken in Afrikaans. But the media company will absolutely kill me if I do that. So, and then we've got a good healthy split of Australians, New Zealanders, Kiwis, and then Latin Americans all sprinkled in there. So,
so at least they'll understand my accents.
Yeah. Yes, correct. Correct. I also get given a lot of shit sometimes, although my English has gotten a lot better since I started yachting in the past 5 years.
Yeah, I can definitely hear that American influence there. Mine is a little bit influenced by, I think, British and, well, Swiss. I mean, Swiss. People tell me I speak like a Swiss person because we lived there for that long. But yeah. I think it's still very much South African. When some of my videos on YouTube go viral, people, like, I would get comments like, what is that horrible accent? Yeah, so anyway, luckily most of the audience can relate to this accent, this horrible accent.
Oh, sure. I don't think it's horrible at all. It actually makes me kind of homesick. So tell us, Carla, who is Carla and how did you become a finfluencer?
I like that term, finfluencer. So I wouldn't identify as a chartered accountant anymore, but in my previous life, I was a chartered accountant and I worked in banking advisory. I worked with the big four firms in South Africa and in London. Then I did an MBA in Switzerland, and I ended up working in Switzerland for the past 3 years. And last year, January, I started my personal finance blog, and it's just kind of taken off from there. To be honest, I was just so lost in terms of, I wanted to change in my career. I didn't know where this is going to go. And I think yachties can probably relate to this, right? Where you almost feel, at least you guys probably have a timeline on how long realistically you could work on the yachts. But for me, I just was not fulfilled in what I was doing and I wanted to do something else. So I started this blog as in literally just writing a blog. Then I started with videos on Instagram, and they're so cringe, my first videos. And it's just started getting traction, and people, my kind of approach was to see what the audience wants and what they need and how I can help. And then later I can see if I can monetize that. And they just, you know, people flooded to this because all of a sudden there's this like girl that not only talks about fashion and how to look good, but also like talks about money. And well, not also, I don't talk about those other things. I just talk about money.
Yes.
And anyway, so I started like talking about how should you save, what kind of behavior should you implement in your financial life. But then I put polls on my story. What do you want to hear, learn more about? And everyone wanted to know more about investing. So it's kind of found, the investing route found me. I didn't know that it's such a popular topic. I thought everyone kind of knew what's the best way to invest. And I quickly realized, like, most of the people that studied with me that are chartered accountants and have MBAs didn't know how to invest smartly. So then I developed a course on investing, and that's kind of really taken off. And that's also helped me monetize my channel. Anyway, so that's how I got where I am. Now I want to solve many financial problems for people besides just helping them invest. Like, I want to focus on finances for couples, finances for kids, budgeting, you know, just getting like a proper budget and financial plan going. So yeah, many avenues. The first one was investing, and you know, just getting started, to be honest.
That's brilliant. And I think you tapped into a really good market, because I'm sure you've seen there's tons of American and British and all of these money influencers out there. But I, before I stumbled upon your channel, I was yet to find someone that is specific to South Africans. And I mean, yes, there's a lot of universal and general advice that people should follow, but there is the minutiae and the nitty-gritty type of things, like South Africa's tax-free savings accounts and those type of things, which, like you said, even your very well-educated MBA friends, they're not aware of these things, because they are all in this little narrow box, and they just don't think about the holistic picture of your finances. So honestly, kudos to you. My brother actually sent me your channel about a month or two ago, and it's all very insightful. It's entertaining, and I totally feel you on how cringy these things feel in the beginning. Same thing with me. I just started writing newsletters for Yachties. All of them were like, hey, can you make a video here and there? And I don't make nearly the amount of videos you do, but every single time the camera is in my face and I'm talking to it, it's, I want to die. But, but someone's got to do it.
No, and to be honest, I think, yeah, it's a very cringe thing. It doesn't come naturally. I think, honestly, not to anyone. It doesn't come naturally to anyone. Even the best actors in the world went through like an awkward stage at the start when they were faced with a camera. And yeah, so like, I also want to say, encourage people out there that want to start something. It's honestly like, it can be life-changing. You don't, shouldn't worry about the followers and I'm going viral, blah, blah, blah. Just giving yourself the kind of confidence to put something out there, go out of your comfort zone, you know, stop caring what people think. This is like the first step to grow your comfort zone. Like, you should go for it. Anyway, but that's not the purpose of this podcast. So I wanted to quickly mention two things when you spoke about the American focused content out there for finance. Is you open yourself up for, the thing is, people easily follow the American content because obviously the market is massive. So there are so many people focusing on the US market. But for any non-US investors that are not based or actually don't plan to live in the US long-term, if you hold US assets directly, as in if you invest in ETFs, we can get to that a little bit later, I guess. But if you hold US assets directly and you end up retiring, for example, in South Africa, and you pass away, your estate is exposed to U.S. assets, and there is a slightest tax risk, which you might read about online if you read about non-U.S. investors. And a lot of people just follow the American online advice, buy VOO and buy these like ETFs that all of the influencers say, but they don't realize that by holding U.S. assets, like ETFs in the U.S., you expose yourself to slightest tax when you pass away. And that could mean that your estate upon death is taxed in the US at a very unfavorable CITES tax rate, which is 40%, can go up to 40% for assets above $60,000. So yeah, that's just something. So I think that is also where my content becomes valuable, because I'm focusing on non-US markets, and I'm basically helping people to say, yeah, okay, this is what the American advice is, but let's apply it to your scenario and let's watch out for the mistakes that you could make.
That's brilliant.
And the other thing, The other thing is that I think the yachts are the original like digital nomads. It's not like you don't work digitally, but you literally have like lives like everywhere, and you don't know where you're going to retire. You don't know where you're going to work next year. You don't like, you can't kind of plan your life that way. And the whole world of a lot of people are moving towards that kind of lifestyle where people are like, I worked in London and I got some pension there from my employer. Then I moved to Switzerland and I got some pension there. Then I'm like getting some money in South Africa through. And now all of a sudden we have assets all over the world and we have no idea how to be smart about the tax, how to consolidate our assets. And even like, should I now sell my pension or should I exit my pension in the UK and rather move it somewhere else? And so this is also where I think my channel becomes interesting, because I'm serving a fragmented market, because all of a sudden people are like everywhere. We move around so much. We're not like working in one country and, you know, retiring and dying in that country anymore. So I think that this is also probably where people are like hungry for someone that's relatable in that sense.
It is, and it's very beneficial for you and your family, because this is your new career. You need to put out accurate content, which means you are being held accountable by having to do a lot of research. And I'm pretty sure that in making some of these videos and answering some of the polls, you've stumbled upon some information that you didn't know. And I see myself as quite the finance nerd, and I'm very aware of how things happen between South Africa and the US. I wasn't aware of CITES tax at all. And this is something that right after this phone call, I will be calling my accountant and saying, why didn't you tell me about this? We spoke about these things. You're shedding light on an important topic for sure.
And I don't think the CITES tax thing shouldn't be there to like scare you. I think big wealth managers love to bring this up and say, oh, but what about CITES tax? Because they want to keep the secrets and not kind of democratize the information, where it would literally just mean holding the same ETF, but it's just listed in Ireland or in Luxembourg instead of it being listed in the US. So you get exactly the same assets. Sometimes the expense ratios are a bit higher, but you're just holding your assets in Ireland or Luxembourg where you're not exposed to the CITES tax risk. And that's really what it is in essence.
So basically, it's just the ticker. It's not VOO, which is the Vanguard fund. It's a different one, but it still tracks the S&P 500 index.
Exactly. Understood. So that's all it is. And you can just basically sell yours and move it over to the right one now, or when you become closer to the time that you perhaps think of moving back to South Africa or something like that.
I see. Interesting. And while we're on that topic, that's kind of a good segue for us to get into the ETFs and index fund debate. So for the listeners out there that have never heard, what is an index fund? What is an ETF? Can you please dumb it down like we are 5 years old?
Yes. So I've tried this many times. I think quite a good recipe by now. So an index is really, you have hundreds of different indices, which is a plural of an index, across the world. And they have different purposes, but it's really just a list of something. As in the case of an S&P 500 index, it's the list of the 500 biggest companies listed in the US. And then you have an MSCI World Index, which is the list of companies that makes up 85% of the equity opportunity in developed markets. Okay, I don't want to use too much financial jargon now, but let's say you have what is the example I use? The coolest cool drink list in a supermarket. That would be, let's call it the cool drink index. And that would mean going into a supermarket and asking them, hey, what's your cool drink index today? And they would say, oh, okay, here's a list of the 10 most popular cool drinks bought in our store over the last week. But next week you go and you ask again, what is a cool drink index? And they will say, okay, the index has changed a bit because Pepsi has become more popular than Coke, or Fanta is now on and Red Bull is off or whatever. But here is the list again. So the list has kind of, it's dynamic, it changes. And now you can basically take that list and go somewhere and say, okay, I want to buy this cool drink index. You know, give me the top 10 drinks that you have and I want to own them. And you can exactly like replicate that scenario to the stock market and say, I just want to buy the most or the biggest companies in the US and own a portion of 500 biggest companies in the US or the 1,800 biggest companies in the world, in developed markets, in the case of the MSCI World. But an index is really just a list that gets updated mostly just quarterly. And an ETF is stands for an exchange traded fund. That's really just a structure that gives you access to owning the companies on this list. And there are like three major indices that I usually would refer to: the S&P 500 one, which is 500 biggest companies in the US, and it's the most popular biggest index by far. And there are many ETFs that track that index, and they all basically achieve the same thing. Yes, there are some slight differences. Some have dividends that are reinvested, others paid out dividends. Total expense ratios, etc., differ a bit, but they all really achieve the same thing. So people would sometimes get confused and be like, okay, but which one should I choose? You should choose the index that you want to invest in, first of all, and then the ETF, because they mainly do the same thing.
Yes.
I mean, there are some more intricate details to consider, but I don't want to get into too technical detail. And then, so S&P 500 first, then the next one is like an MSCI World Index, which tracks the developed markets. Only, which is 23 developed markets. So then you will include Japan and Canada and Australia and some other like UK and Switzerland, etc., and the developed markets. And then if you want to add emerging markets into that, so that you want to track like 23 developed markets and 24 developing markets or emerging markets together, that's like super diversified. That would mean a FTSE All World Index or a MSCI All Country World Index. But it sounds much more complex than it is. And that's actually like, just go and Google these abbreviations or go look it up and be like, oh, I want an index that tracks all the stocks in developed and emerging markets, or most of them. What would that be? And then you would get your answers. Or not ChatGPT. I know people don't use Google.
Yeah. Yes, no, that's a good explanation. And in saying all of that and explaining that, it just brings me back to the conviction. And thank you, John Bogle, for inventing the index fund ETFs, because what you mentioned there with your cool drink analogy. So if you walk into the grocery store next week and they say, oh, the list has changed, the ETFs do the same thing. The index does the same thing. It's a self-flushing mechanism that pulls out the losers from the bottom. And therefore, you never have to be a stock-picking genius, because quite frankly, since the inception of these, it's very difficult to beat the market over the long term. And you are way better off and will have a much more chilled life if you just buy and follow the ETFs, because instead of analyzing 500 stocks, going through their 10Ks, looking at balance sheets, you can now just buy one singular instrument that tracks the entirety of it. So it's a brilliant invention, and one that I tell everyone to do. Stop asking what individual stock is the play and stop chasing the shiny thing. Stop looking for the next NVIDIA or the next Tesla. It is in there already. You have large exposure to it, which brings me to my next point. Yes, we are diversified. Let's take our S&P 500 index as an example. Yes, there's 500 companies, but as you know, and the listeners might not, this is a weighted index. So it's weighted by market cap. So the top seven of these stocks, which the markets often refer to as the Magnificent Seven, your Apple, your Google, your Amazon, your Meta, etc., they carry a large percentage within this index. Do you see that as a risk, or is that just part of the natural fluctuation of the balance of the market?
I like 100% see that just as being part of the index investing game, and kind of following the market cap of these companies and being exposed to more of them when they're bigger and taking up a bigger portion of the weighted allocation. Just because since 1992, when the first S&P 500 ETF was listed, SPY, they've always there's always been an overexposure or a bigger allocation to certain companies. So yes, it now it might be bigger than ever, and we should talk about why. Like the allocation to the concentrated risk into a few companies is now more than ever before. But at, you know, there was always before an overexposure to certain companies, and people used to say, "Oh, GM have too much exposure, or Exxon or IBM or whatever, too much exposure to those," and they kind of just flushed out and got replaced by others. Not got replaced. They just took a smaller allocation, and then you know, the new guys came on the block. So something that I think is really interesting is rather why do these companies have such a big allocation? So yes, of course, we can talk about is are these growth stocks overvalued right now? Is everyone, you know, trying to get in because it's shiny and that pushes up the price of these stocks? But the other thing to think of is the way that the world operates and that tech companies tech as an industry is just completely different to what we've ever seen before, because every single industry in the world now, all of a sudden, has a big exposure or element of technology involved in the business. So before, you had the automotive industry that didn't have any involvement with technology. Now you have, you know, there's such a massive reliance on technology in automotive, not only manufacturing, but also just in self-driving cars or in the solar technology that's in these cars. Or, you know, so it's just, I think that all of a sudden, technology plays a big part in all of these industries. So it makes so much sense that it takes up a bigger portion. And the other thing is these companies sell globally to, like, all of a sudden Facebook or Meta owns advertising. They own the advertising channels to so many consumers in all over the world. Okay, perhaps not so much in the East, but all over the world now, I get an ad, like if I'm based in Switzerland, I get an ad on Instagram that's sponsored by Swiss Post, which is the postal service in Switzerland. They pay Meta in the US to run this ad to me. And so that revenue goes to the US. So it's all like, yes, okay, it's quite concentrated, but all of a sudden these channels are owned by US companies. And that also, I think, drives a lot of this overexposure to certain companies. I don't know if that's my explanation.
It makes a lot of sense. That's a very good point. And then to stay with, to kind of get away from the stocks for a moment, and something that I'm sure you get asked a lot: what about Bitcoin? Do we buy crypto? What is crypto? Shed some light on your opinion on this pretty rough topic.
So I think, you know, I have to say that I'm definitely not your typical like crypto bro. I'm not one that's trying to push Bitcoin or crypto or meme coins or whatever. The fact that I am quite confident to also confidently say I think it's a good it's good to have some allocation to Bitcoin in your portfolio means that it has taken me some time to actually get to this opinion. It's not that I didn't make millions from it and I'm just trying to push up the price or something like that. This is really like an opinion that has taken me long to actually form and also have the confidence to share. I actually got exposed to Bitcoin the first time when I really got educated on it from one of my finance professors at business school in Switzerland. And he just explained it in such a simple way, which is hard to do for me without like charts and slides. But in essence, I think once you have the use case and you've actually seen it in practice and you've seen, okay, I'm actually paying my video editor who's based in Mexico with Bitcoin because it's the cheapest way for me to transfer currency to him. If I had to go through the traditional, you know, routes, I would have to pay a lot of conversion fees to get the money to him. And he also has to pay fees to get it into his account. So we just kind of like skip all of that red tape, skip all of the traditional financial intermediaries that all want a cut out of our transaction. And I just buy a few like coins, not full coins. Some Ethereum, whatever, you know. And send him some. And it's so much quicker. It can literally happen like instantly. We don't have to wait for the banks to approve the transactions and the flows to happen. And it also, you know, it's so much cheaper. So that's just a very simple use case. I mean, then we start looking at the blockchain technology behind it and all of the And then people are going to tell you, yes, but we've been talking about use cases for so long, and when are we actually going to see this in practice? And I think something is so true that the technology takes so long to be adopted, much longer than we expect. Mm-hmm. But the fact that I compare Bitcoin more to like a type of a digital gold and
store of value.
This is really because it's a way to transfer value. When I say store value, people are like, yeah, but it's so volatile. How can you store value in it? It's not, of course, like gold has some volatility as well. Bitcoin is more volatile because it hasn't been around that long. I mean, if you could go back to the 1600s, which we obviously don't have much data on, what was gold worth then and how much did it fluctuate? Like, I wish we knew, because I'm sure in South Africa, gold would have a different price than in the US, mm-hmm. In the 1600s. So I'm sure it was volatile then, but now Bitcoin hasn't been around that long. The volatility will probably taper off. But then the question is, do we have this like high expected return from Bitcoin when it becomes less volatile? Because with this volatility is obviously this higher expected return. If it starts acting like gold, or, you know, is it still going to be like as interesting? Anyway, that's just like an open thought. But in the essence, like, just to get back over the comparison to gold, this is really just a way for you to say people put their money into gold. Usually when they want to run away from risk, right? When something happens and the people run to gold, where in Bitcoin, some cases it acts that way, some cases it doesn't. Sometimes it moves with the stock market, equities, other times it moves against. So we don't have that kind of decorrelation, if that's the right word, yet.
Yeah.
But I think that in a way, it does act like a store of value, because I can literally put 10,000 Swiss francs into Bitcoin, give that Bitcoin to someone else, and they can, if they want, use Bitcoin just like it, or they can transfer it to their local currency. So the fact that I can actually put value into it and they can get value out of it, that means there is a value transfer and there is a store of value within this currency. But now you just have so many countries saying, okay, you know, we're going to start including Bitcoin as part of our treasury reserves. And that's a massive move. And so many institutions are also starting to offer Bitcoin ETFs. So I think we're moving towards a bigger mass adoption. But exactly what this is going to look like, I think is going to be interesting, because governments, this is not one thing, one open source I have, is that governments are not going to allow a currency to go like be mass adopted if it's going to mean that they can potentially lose out on tax revenues, because now people can start transacting and almost hiding revenues yes. from the tax authorities. And also if it's going to be mean money laundering, because this is one way financial institutions can prevent money laundering is by regulating transactions. And Bitcoin, as we all know, is known for allowing illegal transactions. So how are governments going to react? So stable coin, then are you going to have central bank backed digital coins? Or
yeah.
Anyway, I think it's a really interesting time to be part of. I would include it in my portfolio, but probably not that much. When I say on Instagram videos, I would usually say like 5 to 10%, because I mean, I have to, like, I speak to a retail crowd and I don't want them to put all of their like life savings and children's education funds into Bitcoin, but because Carla said something, right? But then I always have people commenting, oh, you're crazy, you should go 60% of your portfolio into Bitcoin. And I'm all about diversification. So Bitcoin is just one type of technology or coin to get exposure to, right? You know, there are so many other industries that you should be thinking of to also get exposure to. So that's just my opinion. What do you think?
Well, so I, same thing, very, very, very skeptic in the beginning. Kind of got exposed to it the first time in the 2017 bull run when I was still a student at university. Some friends bought the high, absolutely got wrecked. So I was just naive and didn't do any research. And I was like, okay, yes, must be a scam. And then next time around in the second bull run in my crypto lifetime was the first time I actually had a bit of money. That's when I had already started yachting. So I went, I read the white paper by Satoshi Nakamoto, and I read the Bitcoin Standard and tried to educate myself. And the conclusion, my aha moment was the day I realized that this is the first form of asset class that I'd ever heard of that has an actual finite supply. Whereas gold holds a lot of value because we don't find gold every day under our mattresses. They have to go look for it, and they've most likely probably earthed a lot of the gold already. Money, cash, fiat money, can be printed out of thin air. This we know. The US government loves doing that, especially. So Bitcoin, and we can do a whole episode on this, but it's got a finite supply of 21 million coins that can never change. That is how the program's written. So for that reason, I really like it, because your demand elasticity will never be influenced by a printer making more of it. So once I clicked that, I was like, oh, okay. And the fact that this was not widely adopted back then, but it did start making news headlines, etc. And I remember people going crazy when the all-time high hit $64,000 in 2020. And then now, if it goes to that price, people are screaming and saying Bitcoin's dead and it's over. So for me, yes, it's very volatile. Have a stomach of steel when you do end up adding this to your portfolio, and just don't look at it. In my opinion, and once again, everybody listening, not financial advisor, but what I have found has worked for me over the past 4 years is just setting up a dollar cost averaging approach. So every week on a Thursday evening, I buy $50 of Bitcoin, and that just ticks along, and that cuts through all the waves and volatility, and it's done really well. My crypto portfolio is up well over 500%. So that's not really the returns I'll be getting in the stock market per se. So to me, having that asymmetrical return potential in my portfolio is very well worth the risk. Also, I'm saying all that being a yachty with a very unusual lifestyle, and the fact that we don't really have a lot of expenses, so I can take a bit more risk. I don't have a child yet. So there's a lot of factors at play here. To me, I keep it around 10 to 20% of my liquid portfolio, and then rebalance as it reaches highs throughout the cycle. Take some profits, take some lifestyle chips off the table, and that way I stay disciplined by keeping it a certain percentage of my portfolio, and I'm actually taking some cash off to enjoy myself, because I was willing to ride through the turbulence. So now I get to buy nice shit. That's how I feel about it.
Sounds like a good trade-off.
Yes.
But Shaul, I feel like we have so many good topics that we need to still discuss, because I know that on our notes, I wanted to talk about property, because I think that, you know, I have to say that I've learned this through a lot of trial and error. But I first want to ask you for your opinion on, like, what is the general feeling in the industry on property investments? So we have to talk about property, because I know it's quite a popular topic of discussion. But I first want to know, I've been through all the ups and downs in terms of property investments, and I've come to, like, my conclusions. I want to first hear from you, how popular is it as an investment? Is it, like, the go-to investments in the industry?
Okay, so like you said, this is quite a polarizing topic, because it's not easy. It's not easy like quickly opening your Interactive Brokers account and buying Apple stock. There's a lot of complexity, a lot of nuance, and a lot of steps to the process. If you had asked me this after my second apartment purchase, I would tell you don't ever buy a property. Real estate is bullshit, and it doesn't deserve a place in your portfolio. But that was because I made some rookie mistakes. I purchased the property without going there. I did it all from sitting in my cabin overseas and trusting real estate agents to do thorough walkthroughs, etc. So, okay, I'm not answering your question yet, but I do like property. I do like property. Very case specific to... going to use myself as an example. South African yachty that lives abroad and earns US dollars. So for me, that is adding properties to my portfolio in South Africa. it makes a lot of sense because I require a very small down payment, which with the US versus ZAR exchange rate is not that much money. And therefore, if you can buy a property that can be pretty cash flow positive from the get-go, that meaning you Airbnb it and get enough bookings, or you have long-term tenants, which is what I do because it's a lot less work. And if you ensure that your tenant covers your mortgage payments, or at least very close to it, to me, it's a no-brainer because I'm putting down 10% on a 2 million rand asset and someone else is paying the rest of the loan off for me. So I like property as an asset class because of the fact that you can leverage the bank's money and then get someone else to pay for it. I do, however, do not believe that owning a home as your primary residence is necessarily the best financial investment. I do understand that this is not necessarily a monetary and a economic decision. Some people just like having the peace of mind knowing my child is sleeping in a house where there's just a lot of security to it. But in terms of, to me, real estate only makes sense when someone else is paying off your mortgage. That's my hot take on real estate. I've made some mistakes. I have two very successful cash flow positive properties. I have one that is still giving me pain to this day, but this is lessons learned. And a lot of yachties that find the stock market and crypto and everything very daunting, they do like to go to real estate because it's tangible. They can see it. They've heard for generations. You can't, what do they always say? You can't go wrong by purchasing property. You're like, not really true, bro. You can go very fucking wrong for buying property sometimes if you don't know what you're doing. And you buy an area that is not necessarily appreciating. And you don't take all the phantom costs into consideration because you look at the listing price of a house. It's not stopping there. You're paying 100,000, 200,000 rand in transfer costs. You have to pay insurance. And then if you happen to be unlucky and you get a horrible tenant, there's a lot of laws in many countries that protect the tenant versus the landlord. And I have a friend that has just had someone stay in his house for 10 months without paying a month's rent. And he couldn't evict him, even though he called the police so many times. They're like, yes, what do they call it in South Africa? Squatter rights. So there's pros and cons. You got to do your own research on this topic. For me, it's worked out. And to me, I know that I have three tangible assets at home for if the world completely goes to shit, I at least have something to show for it at home. And that's my long-winded opinion on property.
Okay. Are you ready for me?
Hit me.
So I think you mentioned, just to quickly go on to the unexpected costs associated with property, is that, so like you also have rent and taxes that you need to pay as an owner, and you also will have rent and repairs, you know, that you would have to pay up for. And if someone like does, you know, sometimes even the deposit on a property is not sufficient to cover any damage done potentially by the tenant, right? But those are like all risks that I have now with time learned. My dad has built up property portfolio, and you know, looking back at those assets in over 20 years or 30 years that he's owned them, not one of them was actually a good investment. And like I obviously now sit with this like regret that we didn't make a change earlier in his life, just because it could have been many millions more if we could have invested it's more like smarter in the stock market. But something that you mentioned is very real, is that people tend to flock to real estate because it's much more tangible. And it's something that we've been taught from a young age is a good, like when someone tells you they own property, even now when I say my dad has a property portfolio, everyone's like, oh, must be thinking, wow, but her father must be so wealthy. Or yeah. Or when you say you own a house and people are like, wow, you own a house, you know? And people don't feel the same way about stock portfolio. And if I say you're my dad's stock portfolio, then everyone's like, okay. Where I think it should be the other way around. I'm like, damn, it's impressive that you have a stock portfolio. You've got Bitcoin. Tell me more. And I'm thinking, like, if you tell me you've got property, then I'm always thinking, oh, damn, shame, you probably don't know what you're getting yourself into. But, you know, I think I worked in real estate for a long time. I worked for a private real estate, private markets real estate investor in the UK that had a portfolio of £1 billion. And they had massive leverage on the portfolio. They also had external investors in taking on the equity portion of these investments. And it was hotels, residential blocks, office space, big, big, good locations. And I just, you know, kind of learned with time that there's always like so many costs that people are also not necessarily aware of upfront. And also people make the mistake of not even comparing it or having a benchmark in mind of what their expected return in the stock market would be. And a very common mistake that people make that have some international exposure, but South African exposure, is they compare their returns in Rand to returns that they could get in dollar. So they would say, oh, I'm making 10% on this property. And the S&P 500 makes 10% in dollars. And the S&P 500 is much more volatile and this property is much more stable. So obviously I'm better off in the property. But massive, massive mistake, because actually you should convert your US dollar return of 10% S&P 500 is actually 16 or 17% return in Rand. And that should be your benchmark, in my opinion, because people just compare like returns in different currencies without making the currency conversion. So actually, if you want to think as a dollar investor, like you want to hold your assets or think, have a benchmark in mind of a strong currency, then you should also consider your property's value in dollar terms. And every year, as like the last 20 years, the Rand has lost 6% against the dollar average annual depreciation. So every year, like, let's say your property increases with 6% value every year, it actually loses 6% to the dollar. So technically it stays the same. There's no capital growth in dollar terms. So then we look at the rental yield that you want to get. And once we start looking at rental yield and someone tells me, yes, but my tenants are paying off my bond, then I start saying, once we get into that space that a tenant actually pays off your bond, it usually pushes up the property price, because it's such a lucrative rental yield and because property is so popular with the everyday investor, because it's tangible, it easily is influenced by rental yields, where the estate agent will tell you, oh, this is such a good yield, you're going to pay off your bond, then they're telling it to everyone else, and that also makes the price higher. It's all relative to what the price is that you pay for the property, right? Because the price that you pay determines the yield that you get, determines the leverage on the assets, and also determines the potential capital growth that you're going to get. But anyway, so like I've done all the financial models that you can even think of on this. And I've got some good YouTube videos on property investments too, if you want to go have a look at them. But I'm just like not a fan. And I think, you know, once you get to a significant investment portfolio, like it should always be first priorities, building up a stock portfolio, then you can start thinking of diversifying into some real estate. But also if you enjoy it, like if you enjoy going to your property and like fixing up things and talking to your tenants, I just know it's such a pain, like, you know, having this risk of a squatter, or oh, they're not paying, they're late on their rent, or now the estate agent calls you, the swimming pool is leaking and the geyser burst. And it's really like it's a lot of work, and actually most of the time, from what I've seen, it actually hasn't paid off. So I have a lot of, you know, people that I talk to that present their investment, their property portfolios for review to me. And I've actually like, and I'm talking about good properties, like, you know, I don't want to make too specific examples, but in prime areas and big, like 300, like 300 million plus kind of things, and also smaller ones. But it really becomes, you know, it becomes a game of scale, economies of scale. Like once you get to a mall where you literally have a maintenance team that runs repairs on all of your stores, and you have, you know, then the economies of scale start making sense. But for someone having one apartment here, one apartment there, paying every time someone to go and fix stuff and paying estate agent commissions and all of these things, the margins become super, super thin. And yeah, so I think maybe I have to say everything that I wanted to say on that now is that I would really like encourage you to rather, especially if you're that far away from your real estate, is to think if it's actually worthwhile, because you also mentioned the transfer duty, and there's a lot of inefficiency in this real estate process. You have to, or the seller buys commission. So once you start selling your property, you have to give commission to a real estate agent, unless you can sell it yourself. Then there is a lot of lawyer fees and transfer duties and bond costs involved. So every time you change, it's not as easy as selling a share and just paying a commission to the broker. You know, it's so much like there's so much value that's drawn out of this process, which hopefully blockchain can actually solve in the future for us, right?
But yes.
Yeah, we lose a lot of value along the line. And yeah, maybe I'll change my mind in like a few years.
No, I like that. And I really, what you mentioned something earlier that kind of put me at ease when you said first build a healthy equity portfolio before you start diversifying. And okay, that's a very subjective, what is healthy, what is a lot. But to me, I was investing so aggressively since the moment I started yachting, as in 80% plus of my salary every month into the indexes, that it reached to a point where I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is healthy in my definition of healthy. And now it's maybe time to pivot away and look for safer asset classes. I know mathematically that I have opportunity cost gone astray with money that I've put down on deposits for homes and the occasional, if I'm ready to buy the dip in the stock market. And now, like you said, the tenant calls and it's like, oh, the boiler, the geyser just burst and the place is flooded. And I'm like, fuck, okay, $3,000 to that. And da, da, da. So I understand that. It was just, like I said, it reached a point. And I also had a very specific family situation at home where, to me, I needed cash flow in rands instead of sending US dollars consistently. And that's why I built a property portfolio, to get some income that I can distribute to the people that need it at home. So there's a reason. It's all very case specific, but I really value your contrarian opinion versus mine. It's really important for us in finance to get out of our own feedback loops and echo chambers. So I like that. So yes, everybody, note that Carla hates real estate and you should never buy a house.
Now, one more thing on that quickly is that I met up with a friend in December in Mosul Bay, and her parents were there because they just got her mother kind of inherited a beach, not a beach house, but like a little place at the beach. And her parents were like in a frenzy because her dad is about to retire, can't retire because, and he's a lawyer, but hasn't made enough provision for retirement. And then started digging into these questions. I love understanding the psychology behind this and why you didn't make smarter money choices when you were younger. And also, like, what did you put your money towards? Because obviously you were quite a high earner. So I actually spoke to her parents. Not Afrikaans people in general are not like that open to talk about money, you know? But I really like pulling this out of them. And sometimes they tell me because they want advice from me. So her dad actually said, no, he bought their, he's a lawyer, and he bought the office block that their office is based in. And he thought then, okay, this is going to be his retirement plan. He basically puts all of his money into buying this office block, which was at the time prime location. And now that property has hardly kept up with inflation. So even if he sells that asset now, he there's no way he can afford to retire on this office block, just because it is not worth as much as he thought it would be. Because at the time, real estate was the go-to thing. No one bought stocks. You still had to call someone like 30 years ago to buy a stock, and you could only stock pick, right? There were no ETFs yet. Anyway, so he put like his whole retirement plan into this property, and now they can't retire. Her dad is literally 65 and he has to continue working, hoping he can still get clients, and he can't move to the beach where he wants to because he was reliant on a property. He made like certain bets on it and it never paid off. And this is also why then people might say, oh, but stock market can do the exact same thing. When you buy an ETF, you literally get exposure to more than 10 industries. So it's healthcare, it's communications, financial services, real estate. You actually have real estate in an ETF as well. So it's really like a much more diversified way to invest. Actually, it's counterintuitive because you buy one single unit in an ETF, or like one line item in your portfolio, perhaps if you just buy one ETF. But actually, like real estate is so concentrated risk on one area, one tenant potentially, one currency, one country. It's really like concentrating your risk in when you go into that. But okay, so that is like perhaps just a warning. I think I've said enough now. You can watch my YouTube videos on property if you're interested.
Great, thanks. So I think, Carla, you and I clearly talk a lot more than we expected. So what I recommend is we do an episode 2 where we dive into the financial SOPs and we dive much more into the money psychology. I have a job still that I have to go do now. You have to go pick up your son. So I just want to thank you so much for your time and coming out. I really enjoy talking to you and like-minded people. And yes, we spoke a lot about South African specific finances today. So apologies to all our non-South African listeners. But I think a lot of the concepts are universal and global and people can learn a lot from you. Before I let you go and before we book our next slot, how can people find you? What is your handle? And anything else you want to leave as final thoughts?
I have so many final thoughts, but at the exact time. So definitely keen to chat more again and understand like your tea specifically, like kind of psychology behind it and how tempting it is to live a high life. Because I can understand that part, but I want to understand better. So where you can find me on YouTube and on Instagram and on TikTok and on LinkedIn. So it's Money with Carla with a C. And I think those are all the platforms. I also have a Substack blog, but you can find that on my website. My website is moneywithcarla.com. And I think everything that you would need to know about me is on there.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time. I hope you have a lovely weekend and we will chat again soon.